The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of 55 KRC, The Talk Station, and Clear Channel Worldwide.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55 KRZ, The Talk Station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening, Mr. Andy Ulrich. Andy, how's it going?
Pretty good. Just don't spread your germs to me.
I'll try not to. I've been infected by my 4.5-year-old, I suppose, and I'm not 100%. Not that I'm really ever 100%, but this is like, you know, a physical ailment now instead of a mental one. So
it
I don't
sucks
know.
When you have to talk for an hour.
No, it's all right. It's only 42 minutes, actually, so hey. Tonight we're going to be talking with Mike Sieglander. Mike is a former lead firearms instructor for the Federal Air Marshals. In addition to his work with the Air Marshals, Mike is a combat veteran, former law enforcement officer, national-level competitive shooter and TV personality. You can see his shows on the Outdoor Channel. Was also a contestant on the first season of Top Shot. Before we get talking to Mike, though, I kind of wanted to talk about something that happened last Saturday, I guess, the 26th. I don't know if anyone noticed or not, there was a shooting out in New Mexico where an individual ambushed some police officers. Luckily, none of the police officers were killed, but four of them were injured, one of them critically, and she just happens to be the wife of a friend of mine, oddly enough. So I'm not going to say like good friend, we went to high school together, but someone I've spoken to and known, been around for a while now. So we're kind of trying to raise funds. Deputy Robin Hopkins, we've made some t-shirts that originally was going to be extra beer money and ammo money for me, some Ballistic Radio t-shirts. But now what we're going to do is donate all the proceeds from our t-shirt sales to Robin and her family. She's going to be in intensive care for at least the next 30 days, the last I heard. So that's going to get expensive. In addition to that, for every t-shirt we sell up to $1,000, up to 1,000 shirts, I'm going to donate $1 of my personal money to Robin and her family as well. So right now we're up around 50 shirts. That's an extra $50 on top of the proceeds from the t-shirts. If you are interested in helping out, you can see our Ballistic Radio t-shirts at booster.com/ballisticradio. Like I said, all proceeds are going to be going to Robin and her family. Also, too, I'm doing a special little thing. If we actually do sell 1,000 t-shirts, which I think is completely possible, there might be a cool prize that someone who's bought a t-shirt may get. In addition to that, Dark Star Gear out of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, one of those Tom. It's like I said, it's a whole lack of DayQuil thing.
You're dead on Facebook tomorrow.
I am. Well, he's probably actually going to start blowing my phone up right about now. anyway, he's a holster maker to the east of Ohio. He's a Steelers fan, too, but he's a decent guy. Anyway, he's really stepped up as well. If you buy 10 t-shirts, let's say you want to get all your Christmas shopping done, you're going to receive a free outside the waistband holster from Dark Star Gear, which is pretty cool. So you're donating money, get a cool t-shirt or 10, and also get a very, very nice holster out of the deal. And also, too, if any business owners or anyone that has a product to offer would like to donate anything to help motivate people to donate money to Robin, that would be entirely appreciated. And you can get a hold of me, john@ballisticradio.com. Or if you call into the station, Eric, the wonderful producer, can get your contact info, 513-749-5500. Or 1-800-823-8255. And you can vouch for people that are just tuning into the show, Andy. I very rarely ask the listeners to do anything at all.
Really, exactly the opposite. You want to keep it, you know, everything.
Yeah.
Very above board, and you're very careful about what you do.
Yeah, yeah, I try. So this is, like I said, the money's going to go directly to Robin and her family. And Eric, you can get a shirt, don't worry. so it's really something where you don't have to worry about, well, you know, what am I doing and all that. Now, one thing I will say is that if you are not the type of person that needs to get something to donate money, it's probably better for Robin and her family if you just donate directly.
Yeah.
Obviously, the T-shirts do cost something to print, and that money gets taken out by the company that's doing the printing. I'm not keeping anything, though, just to be clear. So just, you know, and obviously there's a lot of police officers everywhere that get injured every year. I'd like to be able to do something for every single one of those individuals. I think it takes a special kind of person to do and deal with the things that they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. I'm singling Robin out just because I said, like, there's a personal connection there. Her husband is one of the individuals that founded pistolforum.com, which, honestly, if it weren't for that particular forum and some of the people that I've run into there and some of the things that I've learned on there, you guys wouldn't be listening to a radio show right now. So that's kind of why I feel compelled to do something a little bit more. And like I said, it's just a really good cause. Once again, and I've got links all over the place online, but booster.com/ballistic radio. Shirts are $20, $5 shipping. It's not anything crazy. And goes to help out a very, very brave lady, and also her family. She's got a soon-to-be 2-year-old and then a 20-year-old as well. So, and I know that's, I can't imagine that household right now. 2-year-olds are nuts. So, anyway.
And considering what she's going to go through, she's in for a long recovery.
Yeah, as someone that's spent time not walking before, and I really don't want to get into that, but I have some experience with upper hip femoral injuries, and it is an incredibly excruciating and long, drawn-out ordeal. And any love that we can show and any support that we can show is going to be extremely helpful. So anyway, enough of that for right now. I'll throw another link up onto the Facebook page and mention at the end of the show now, while the sale's still going on, I think we've got 25 days until it closes. But anyway, so in a little bit after this break, we are going to be talking with Mike Seeklander. Should actually be a really interesting show. I've harped on this before as far as the tie-in between competitive shooting and how that may or may not affect you or help you in a self-defense situation. Mike's got quite a bit to say on that topic. Also, too, kind of curious to hear a little bit more about the Air Marshals and what they do, because it's one of those agencies that a lot of people talk about, but I don't necessarily think they have an exact idea of what goes on. But anyway, we'll be talking with Mike right after the break. Right now, though, you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station.
Wealthy and wise, the Steve Perrin Coordinated Financial Planning Studios. This is 55KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station. Brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Tarek in South Africa that purchased a shirt. Also, too, we just sold one to Robert. Thanks for your support, guys. Like I said at the beginning of the show, selling T-shirts to help support Deputy Robin Hopkins that was injured in the shooting last Saturday in New Mexico. Anyway, back to the topic of the show this evening. We've got Mr. Mike Seeklander on the line. We're going to be speaking with him about all sorts of cool things, and I'm going to quit talking now and get him on the phone. So, hi. Mike, are you there?
I am.
Hey, Mike, thanks so much for joining us this evening. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem at all. So for those that aren't familiar with you and your work, do you mind just going into your background a little bit and introducing yourself?
Wow, John, it's like I bounced around a little bit. I am a former Marine, joined the Marine Corps in 1990, and then got off active duty in 94, and did some law enforcement at the local level in Tennessee with the Knox County Sheriff's Department as well as the Knoxville Police Department, and slowly worked my way into federal law enforcement after 9/11. Actually, in December of 2001, I got hired by the Air Marshals as a civilian trainer and then moved into a credentialed position where I flew, and I was also the lead firearms instructor for what they called Phase 2 training program. And from there, I went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center and then to the U.S. Shooting Academy in Tulsa, Oklahoma as the full-time chief operating officer, and now I own my own company, Shooting Performance. So I travel all over the place and teach and compete and write books and articles and stuff like that.
You've got a couple TV shows, too, that you do work for, don't you, as well?
I do. I've been very fortunate. I am co-host of a show called The Best Defense, which is on the Outdoor Channel every Wednesday night, as well as Rapid Fire, and they're both kind of fun, fast-paced shows. One is a little bit more educational. I'm kind of, I guess, for lack of a better term, the firearm self-defense expert on The Best Defense, and then on Rapid Fire, I co-host with Ian Harrison, who I was on Top Shot with briefly, and we do some fun, full automatic testing of some guns and kind of put a fun twist on things.
Excellent. So just out of curiosity, real quick, I'll ask one more personal question, then we'll get more into the meat of the show. How'd you get into shooting, if you don't mind me asking?
You know, my dad was a Marine, and his good friend named John, we used to call him Uncle John, was a police officer, and he used to travel to my house once a year. It must have been around Thanksgiving time, maybe October, late October, November. And he would always bring a service revolver, and he would bring like 50 rounds and would go out behind the house, and he would let me shoot that. And that, and the fact that my family, I grew up in Idaho and Wyoming, we're all hunters and fishers, you know, so I was naturally shooting rifles, but that got me into handgun shooting. And just, I absolutely fell in love with it and bought my own revolver eventually and kind of used to do the same thing every day after school. I would go home, reload 50 rounds on a single stage Lee press that I had, go to the snowbank, shoot the 50 rounds, reload them again, do my homework, and repeat that every single day. So
nice. And turned into a nice little career for you there.
It did.
Yeah, it's just funny how the small things in life. So I guess we'll start, as you mentioned, you were the lead firearms instructor for the Federal Air Marshals. I guess a lot of people have heard about the Marshals, but not many people know what they do. Do you mind explaining kind of like their mission and all that good stuff?
Well, sure. Their direct mission, and they have some small branches where they do some other things, but their direct mission is to provide security, you know, on air carriers nationwide and internationally. So typically, you know, there will be an air marshal, air marshals on an airplane, and their direct role is to intervene and handle situations that are above and beyond what the flight crew can handle or the pilot can handle themselves. And they're armed on the airplane. You know, they also coordinate with anybody else that's on the airplane, and they're specifically trained, for lack of a better term, to counter-hijack an airplane if something bad happens and make sure it can safely get on the ground. You know, and that's the highest level law enforcement duty they have. Of course, they have lower level duties, and you know, they may intervene with an unruly passenger or an effect an arrest in an airport if they see or they witness a crime in action, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. So I guess we'll get into the shooting side of that, and especially since you were their firearms instructor. It strikes me that if I were to be on an airplane and was trying to deal with a situation and I was armed and it was my job to deal with that situation in that capacity, that'd be some really tough shots or tough shooting that I'd have to do. What are some of the issues that the air marshals face if they do have to employ a weapon?
Well, first of all, oftentimes if they have to employ a weapon, you know, a lot of other things have gone wrong. But you're right, there's no candy coating it. And that's why when I first got hired by the FAMS, you know, in December of that year, we had the highest qualification standard of all federal agencies and the toughest qualification course called the TPC. That was later on, it morphed into a course that, in my opinion, was not as skill-enhanced or was not as hard to pass, which, you know, you can argue that both ways. But the bottom line is they're really stringent on their firearms training. They shoot more, or at that time they shot more than any other federal law enforcement agency that I know of. And they also knew the mission. They realized that if they made a mistake and you know, took a bad shot, for example, they could damage the airplane, they could damage the flight crew, they could hit the pilot, which would, of course, affect their ability to get the airplane safely on the ground. So it's a very stringent, accuracy-enhanced environment. It's also a very stringent close-range environment. where you may be literally in contact distance with someone physically fighting it out before having to employ a weapon.
Okay. So there's kind of that mix of an extreme accuracy requirement and then also being close to the attacker or someone they're trying to subdue. So you've got that close quarter techniques thrown in.
Yeah, well, we used to focus a lot on, empty-handed close quarters combatives integrated with, figuring out how to get a firearm into the solution. And the other thing about that, there's not necessarily any backup. So you or your partner or however many fams are on board, and I won't get into those details, but have to solve the situation. And last but not least, there's no cover. So there's not a wall or a piece of cement or a patrol car that you can utilize as cover or an obstacle. It's in your face. Pretty much chaos if it goes down.
Yeah, and I guess hiding behind one of the passengers would probably not be the best thing to do. So
probably not the best solution since they're going to be panicking and moving too. So.
Yeah, I guess I'll come back around to, I'm sure there are some listeners that are going, well, how does this affect me if I have a concealed handgun license and that's what I do? The point I was trying to get at was accuracy in that environment is very, very important. And then also, too, in a lot of the environments that civilians have to deal with, there are bystanders around. I was curious what your thoughts were as far as people's perception of good accuracy, and do you think that people kind of give themselves a lot more room than maybe they should as far as that goes?
I think they do. In all honesty, I think maybe a little bit the opposite. I think a lot of people focus on slow fire range mentality accuracy way too much. Mm-hmm. When they should be evolving and training for realistic combat accuracy. Well, what does that mean? That means that as your training evolves and you go through that evolution, your focus needs to be hitting, having the ability to stabilize your handgun and hit someone while you're moving and they're moving and there may be other people moving around you. And I call it deliberate accuracy, where you can't say, well, this is fast or this is slow. There's no such thing as fast or slow. It's all dictated by the circumstances that it surrounds. And deliberate accuracy means knowing what has to happen to make the shot then, that moment.
Okay. And that actually ties in rather well. We were talking about the FBI Miami gunfight a couple shows ago and how many snapshots the FBI agents had to take. So I guess as far as if we're trying to get precise shots, deliberate accuracy, how do we work on that? I mean, what do we practice, or how do we practice that at the range?
Well, of course, everything starts at the fundamental level, meaning I need to know what it looks like to fire an accurate shot at whatever level I'm trying to hit. And if you look at the context of a civilian or even a police-type gunfight, they're going to be very, very close. So I need to understand, well, at this distance, I need to see this on my sights and this level of stabilization in my handgun to fire a shot and hit the intended combat effective area. And once you realize that, and that's through the mechanics of gripping the handgun properly and managing the trigger so you don't move the gun whatsoever, well, then you simply work on having the ability to do it faster, to recognize what you need to see faster. And oftentimes, classic hard front sight focus, super range accuracy enhanced type training is not the same thing you're going to need, in that real world environment. So, I try to teach people to really focus on the basics, but once you've got those basics down, now you need to push it into the context of where you really might need to use this skill.
Okay. So is that just a matter of learning how to hit things at certain ranges and then speeding up, for lack of a better term, and seeing how fast you go and pushing your limits until they get...
Yeah, exactly right. I call it expanding your control zone. So if your control zone, let's say you want to be able to hit a combat effective area on a person's body, upper chest, 8-inch circle, at whatever speed from 5 yards, well, you need to figure out what it takes to do that. And then after that, you start pushing the pace, whether it's out of the holster or from a collapsed position that you can work where you start to have to work on building your, grip process and stuff like that. And then eventually, once you expand the control zone, you're going to hit a point where you start to fail. You need to push to failure in your training. And then once you recognize that failure, you need to back off into your control zone and then figure out how to expand its limits a little bit. Because if you stay in that failure zone too long, then you're going to be training bad repetitions. You're going to be myelinating improper things in your subconscious.
Okay. So just as far as finding that fine line between, okay, this is about as fast as I can do it, kind of going over that a little bit and then toning it back until, maybe you're doing it right a certain percentage of the time, or what are your...
Exactly. Okay. You know, if if we did 20 repetitions of a drill, let's say, for example, the very first 5 or 6 or 10 would be very technically correct. But as I get to the 6th or 7th or 10th rep maybe, I'm starting to pick up my pace and pick up my pace. Let's say at the rep number 13 or 14, I've reached my maximum speed. I can't do it any faster, and I start to fail because I can no longer control the orientation of the gun. I might do a couple more reps there, and then I'd back into the area where I still had control. I would, like, back it up just here where I still had control over the handgun, and I could see and control what's going on. And then I would try to push it again, and I would back it in. If I couldn't hit what I needed to hit, I would back it off again. Then I would push the, you know, it's kind of like if you were driving a corner with a car continually, and you, every time you hit that corner, you try to hit a little bit faster. And every time you can't make it, you change the angle a little bit, you brake a little earlier, you speed up a little bit later, you do whatever, you change it. That's what you would do in the training repetitions with, you know, a handgun.
All right, perfect. We'll talk about that a little bit more. We've got to go to commercial real quick. When we come back, we're going to talk with Mike a little bit more as far as how do we train to get faster, and also to some of the mental preparation we can do before a fight. Right now, though, you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Thomas Monday in the morning show. You know, Dad's going to be angry about something. He's spleened on every Monday. Tune in 7:05. We'll find out together. 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station. Brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. I love that I get to play heavy metal on an AM.
We're going to put George Jones on sometime for me.
I guess. Right now, we're talking with Mike Seeklander of shootingperformance.com. If you have any questions, you can call us at 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255 if you're out of the area. We'll try and take your calls at the end of the evening if we're able, but sometimes we don't have time, and I apologize in advance if that's the case. So, back to Mike. Mike, are you still there?
I am.
Excellent. So, we were talking about pushing our limits and as far as getting faster, pushing ourselves outside of our comfort zone and backing down just a little bit to expand that comfort zone. I'd kind of like to switch gears a little bit and talk about pre-fight preparation as far as, you know, not only our physical skills, but our mental skills. Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on the victim mindset versus the survivor mindset?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the first thing that people need to do, and unfortunately there are millions of people out there that have their carry permits now. I believe that's the number. I don't know what the final number is, that have never really taken the time to conceive of what a real fight is going to be like. I got my carry permit. I'm going to carry a handgun, but I might be in a fight for my life in a parking lot tomorrow. And, you know, that is a victim mindset, not mentally preparing for what could happen in the future is a victim mindset. So the first thing that I think people need to do is recognize and become comfortable with the fact they might be fighting for their life and they may have to take someone's life, you know, in that particular circumstance. And once they admit that and once they're comfortable with that, well, then the next thing they need to do is start to believe in themselves and realize that I am not going to lose. My family is more important. I am more important than that person that is making the decision that causes me to have to use potentially a lethal force on them. You know, and then that would tie directly in with a tool that I use in both competition and in my defensive classes, and I call visualization. And, you know, that's simply running a video in your mind, you know, in your own mind's eye of, if this happens, then I do this. You know, and your reactions, it could be a myriad of things that you want to visualize, but you want to see yourself succeed, you know, in that horrible situation.
Okay, and just understanding, I guess, that you don't want to be one of those people that says, well, I never thought that would happen to me.
I guess. That's the point. Exactly right, and that's what happens to most people. They literally can't believe it. And, you know, we say that we always have certain responses under stress. You know, some of us may flee and some of us may freeze. Those of us that fight probably, you know, pre-thought this out and said, you know what, I might be in a fight tomorrow, and this is how it's going to go down. And then you visualize that in your mind. And here's the cool thing. Your mind doesn't know the difference. If you sit there and have an avid visualization about, let's say, I'm in the Walmart parking lot, my students will hear this, will laugh, and I got in a fight, and I had to fight for my life after getting maybe cut or hurt or whatever else. If you visualize that as realistic as possible, then see a successful outcome, your brain doesn't know the difference between that happening and you visualizing it. It thinks it's a real event, so it locks it in. It becomes familiar. So when it really does happen, it's not a shock. It's like, oh, okay, I've been here before. You know, move, communicate, grab the handgun, press the trigger, whatever it is.
Right. I guess it just allows you to react a little bit quicker than maybe someone that hasn't thought about it very much. I guess something else, too, that I know that you're a proponent of, and this kind of goes into the visualization part of things. Some people are kind of down on competitive shooting as far as, well, you know, you learn bad habits there, and that's really bad. If you get into a fight, you're going to do something stupid. And then other people are say, well, stress inoculation is always a good thing, handling the gun, you know, under stress, at speed. What do you think, and what would you tell people about that?
Yeah, I would tell people that if they're approaching competition as a training tool for self-defense, then that's probably the wrong answer. They need to go get real training for real self-defense. However, if they're supplementing what they're already doing and testing their marksmanship and manipulation skills, you know, to define those two things, they have the ability to hit a target and manipulate a gun very, very quickly under the stressors of competition, I think it's an extremely viable option. I highly recommend it. And, you know, I mean, I know literally dozens of high-level combat veterans with elite units and group that compete routinely. And they love it. They love the stress they get from competition. But they know, and just as well as I do, that it's not necessarily training. It's simply a testing ground to form. And another side benefit of competition is when people compete, they become passionate about it. That means they train more, they shoot their guns more, they manipulate them more. And as long as you're mindful of the potential pitfalls there, I think it's a very, very successful skill-building tool.
Okay. So just like anything, have a clear idea of what you're doing and what you're not doing and just understand that beforehand?
Absolutely. You know, like I said, you've got to be trained somewhere realistic. But, you know, in the case of the tactical folks out there that are arguing against competitions, rarely do they ever put gloves on or get in close range with someone and attempt to draw their handgun when someone's punching them in the face. So I would submit to them that they're not training realistically either. So there are so many holes in most people's training spectrums that they could fix without, you know, sitting around, you know, kind of powwowing about competition shooters or whatever else. There's a lot more value in it than they would think, believe it or not. Yeah. But you got to have the right mindset. You got to be in the right context and understand it's not training. It's a competition.
Yeah, and I can say from personal experience when I was at Craig Douglas's ECQC class, that really, really wasn't fun when someone was sitting on top of me shooting me with my gun.
That's right.
Yeah. Andy, you had a question?
Yeah. So really what you're advocating is, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, competition, learning from competition, but you need a mix of competition and actual training to inoculate yourself to not make those wrong moves.
Absolutely. And it's in my opinion, it's probably got to be a stronger mix, i.e., if I had to give you a percentage, you know, a person that really cares about self-defense, mm-hmm. they need to be spending the majority of their time training
right.
with that exact gear in that exact context and that exact situation, 60-75% plus time, and then supplement it with some matches here and there in the competitive environment to see how good their shooting skills are against a competitive shooter out there. You know what I'm saying?
And right. and when you die in training, it's a learning experience. You're not going to make that same mistake again.
No.
Especially if it hurts.
Yeah, you saw the photos of my head after
absolutely. I had a few little dings here and there from TDI after the last time there.
I got shot in the head several times a few weeks ago, Mike. switching gears just a little bit, we'll go back to the Federal Air Marshals. We're talking with Mike Seeklander, who, amongst his many accomplishments, used to be the lead firearms instructor for the Federal Air Marshals. They're kind of famous for using the 357 SIG. They're one of the last major federal agencies that do so. Do you have a caliber that you prefer over others? What are your thoughts on the 357 SIG? And do you mind explaining your reasoning real quick? We got about 2 minutes before the commercial.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. You know, I know I can hear the 45 ACP guys yelling at me now. Man, I'm a 9mm fan, and here's the deal. Short story version, you know, if you look at some of the ballistic testing on the 9mm that's out today, it is performing potentially as good as most of the 45 and better than some of the 40 out there. You know, you can train cheaper, you can train more, you get less recoil, you get more rounds, which especially with a small single step, you know, sub, you know, small carry gun, we may make a mistake as a human and throw three or four rounds in the unknown before we finally start to get hits on target. So believe it or not, all my carry guns, I'm a fan of 9mm. A good, you know, stopping, you know, something that's vetted 9mm.
Right. Caliber. I'm actually a fan of the Federal HST.
I am too.
Yeah, it's what I carry. Not the Hydra Shock that some people get confused, but and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. And actually, that's kind of a setup question, just because pretty much everyone that works that works here at the show is a 9mm fan. I guess Jim 45, isn't he?
I think Jim is 45.
It's because he's old.
But he's no.
He's not here right now, so I can make fun
of
him too.
He's going to get you back for that one.
He's not going to listen to this show. He's busy doing family stuff. I'm sorry, Mike. We've been tangentializing tonight, probably because I've got some sort of head cold, and the cold medicine has got me all hopped up.
Okay.
Just, I guess, your opinion on this, and then we'll go to commercial. Would you say the most important thing about any of this is have a gun?
Yeah, I would have to say have a gun and know how to use it. You know, train with it, and that's the two equations. If you don't have a gun, it's irrelevant anyways. But a whole lot of people out there have guns. I'm around people all the time that have been shooting for their entire life, or so they say, and they know nothing about the gun they're carrying.
Yeah, I've been shooting for years. We'll get into that more. Right now, Mike, we're going to go to commercial. When we come back, Mike's going to answer any questions that you guys have. No one on the line right now, so you can get a hold of us at 513-749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. He's also going to tell us about some of his upcoming projects. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Glenn Beck.
This will blow your mind.
Tomorrow at 9:06 on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station. Brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. If you have any questions, you can get a hold of us at 749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. We've got at least one person on the line, but for some reason, when I touched my monitor, it decided to die.
You gave it a virus.
I did give it a virus. right now, we're talking with Mike Seeklander, former lead firearms instructor for the Federal Air Marshals, as well as some other things. So anyway, Mike, are you still there?
I am.
Excellent. If you want to tell us about any of your upcoming projects real quick, and then if it's all right with you, we'll take a couple phone calls if the phone doesn't die as well. So
yeah, sure, man. That sounds good. I have actually one of the bigger things I'm doing is I'm trying to finalize my third book in my training series. And right now I have a competition handgun training program. I have a defensive handgun training program. And now I'm working on a defensive rifle training program. And that particular book will be supported by two DVDs like my other two books. And the way I do it is, you know, I believe in systematic training, meaning I'd love to get you into class somewhere if I can, but I know that's not realistic for everybody out there. So for those that can't do that and or that want to supplement the class with something after the class, you know, my other two books are 300-plus pages. They're full training programs. They address the mental stuff, the physical stuff, the fitness stuff, dry fire and live fire drills, and this new book will address all that stuff with rifles. And, you know, all of the Americans that own, you know, black rifles, AR-15s, M4 systems, as well as the AK variants, you know, lots and lots and lots of folks out there that probably don't really know what to do when they go to the range. So that's the project.
Okay. And the best way, again, to get a hold of those if people want to purchase that?
Yeah, everything is going to be linked on my website as well as the release, and you can pre-register for the book and get on my newsletter, and that's shooting-performance.com. I guess it's actually a hyphen. That's the part some people miss. And if you fail to find my website, you can Google my name and find me very easily, but it's www.shooting-performance.com.
Excellent. And I've got a link up on our webpage, and I'll put another one up on the show's Facebook page. Well, Mike, we've got at least three people on the line right now. I've fixed my computer monitor, too, by smacking it on its side. It seemed to work. Do you mind taking a couple phone calls?
No, as many as you want.
Okay. Well, we got about 8 minutes, so we'll see how many we can run through. Right now, we're going to talk to Rich from Aurora, Indiana. Rich, how are you doing tonight?
Okay, how are you guys doing?
Not too bad at all. Thanks for calling in. What can we help you with?
I actually had a question for Mike. Y'all was talking about your favorite calibers. I've always been a big fan of the 44 Special, and nobody else seems to give a hoot about that. You can't find ammo for it. Nobody seems to see the good aspects of it, in my opinion. I was just curious of what he thought of that caliber.
Mike?
Yeah, Rich, you know, the 44 Special, any large caliber like that is going to be a very effective stopper. Of course, you know, with the 44 Special, you're not going to find a lot of platforms that you would shoot a caliber like that. And, you know, for my personal example, that's not something that you would find chambered in the guns that I typically would carry. But, you know, I don't know that there's a significant difference in, for example, a 9mm versus a 44 Magnum, if you want to go all the way to the upper end of the spectrum, in true stopping power if you have a good defensive caliber and you're effective placing those hits. So, Rich, if you shoot a 44 Special and you shoot it in a gun that you shoot well and you can get hits, you know, quickly where you need to, then I'm going to tell you it's going to be a very effective stopping caliber.
Yeah, I've always been fond of it. I've actually got a Taurus. It's, believe it or not, it's got fixed sights, and it's only got a 3-inch barrel, and it is literally the most accurate revolver I've ever shot in my life. Anybody that shoots it tries to buy it off of me for a month after
wow.
they shoot it.
Yeah, I mean, and I've had good luck and bad luck with Taurus revolvers, so it's kind of interesting. They seem to be kind of hit or miss. But, I mean, the other thing to keep in mind, too, Rich, is that even if you make an effective hit on somebody, and we were talking about this a couple weeks ago, it might take more than one. And if you've only got 5 or 6 rounds on board, you know, especially if you have multiple attackers, that's something to consider. But
that is the downside, I think, of too, because it is just a 5-shot. But,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. I just, you know, I don't have anything against semi-autos. You know, I've got a few, but it's just, that thing is just, you know, it's just so simple and so accurate that it's like a security blanket.
Oh, yeah, and at the end of the day, man, whatever you're comfortable with, you're carrying a gun, you're being safe with it, rock on. But, hey, I appreciate you calling in. I'm going to try and get to some other callers now. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
All right, thanks.
Hey, thanks for listening.
Bye, Rich.
So, all right, that was Rich. We've got George from Madeira. He's got a question about moving to cover and practicing that, I believe. George, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right.
I just wanted to get Mike's opinion about something. When you're in a situation where you're shooting and someone's shooting at you, and I understand all the training and having to orientate to the target and be as accurate and as fast as you can, I'm sure if there is cover, you're trying to move to cover as well, and you're trying to move whichever way you have to. If you don't practice moving backward and moving forward and moving side to side, have the proper footwear that will allow you to do that and the proper clothing that allows you to draw from concealment, you're really in trouble if you're not wearing the same equipment when you're in that shooting situation. Anybody ever try going backwards and trying to shoot and wearing different shoes than what you trained in, you may not be going backwards correctly.
Well, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I actually I took private instruction with Robert Vogel, and I showed up wearing flip-flops at his gravel pit behind his house, because that's what I wear. And he's like, you're going to wear those all day? And I'm like, yep.
You're going to be hurting.
No, I was fine. I put a rock through the front of my toe, but I didn't really notice. So. But so, yeah, I mean, that's something to keep in mind. Is you want to practice with realistic conditions and all that. George, I appreciate you calling in tonight and sharing that.
Okay, you have a good show. Keep it up.
Hey, thanks, George. I appreciate
it.
Bye-bye. So, Mike, we've got another John, and it's not me, I swear, from Ohio. He's got a question for you. John, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what's your question?
Mr. Seeklater, I'm curious. I'm a local gun trainer here in southwestern Ohio, and in training a lot of the civilians, I'm former military law enforcement. I'm finding that in trying to get them in the mindset of situational awareness, that by the time they draw the gun, they've had to already made the decision that they're in defense of themselves and they're probably going to have to shoot at that point and everything, getting them to understand that. Are you coming across the same thing in training civilians?
I do, and I call it that concealed carry card mentality, John. It's literally, basically, it's kind of like when people get a driver's license, they just assume that they know how to drive, and we see that that's wrong. Teenagers all the time crashing cars and stuff like that. So the bottom line is, you can lead horses to water. You can't always make them drink, but you've got to constantly preach the aspect of, you know, if you're accessing a firearm, you're drawing a firearm out, it's likely you're not brandishing a firearm. You're not threatening with a firearm. You're not doing anything else with it. You're drawing the handgun to shoot. And that's early in the show, we talked about the accepting responsibility and recognizing that I might be in a fight for my life tomorrow, and I might have to kill someone because of that. And with someone that hasn't had law enforcement or military experience, oftentimes you've got to continually preach that, you know, John. Eventually, most people will get the message, and those that aren't, you know, maybe are better off not relying on a handgun for their self-defense, you know, looking at other options or whatever. But just continually preach the message. But just trust me, eventually you'll get through.
I'm glad I'm not the only one experiencing it.
Hey.
Thank you.
Hey, John, I appreciate you calling in tonight. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Thank you.
Hey, no problem. So, Mike, we've got one more caller on the line, and he's from out your direction. We've got Rick from Oklahoma. Rick, how are you doing tonight?
Practice, Nick, John, and I'm doing fine.
Oh, Nick, sorry, Eric, you're fired. No. Anyway.
Hey, no, I get a chance to train, three or four times a year with nationally recognized trainers, everything from the pure shooting courses to tactics courses, one of which I just attended with you, John, a couple weeks ago.
Ah, that Nick.
And, that Nick. And so, who are some of your favorite trainers, Mike, and some of your nationally and maybe regional trainers that you like?
Man, you know, I there's a group of guys that I know. Some of the guys that are teaching that are some of the former military guys. I know Jim Smith personally pretty well, and he's a good trainer. I don't know what he's doing as far as handgun stuff. He does some phenomenal rifle instruction down in his place in Texas. I'm friends and know Rob Pincus well, and those that know Rob and I both will know that Rob and I have some different opinions about some things, but he has a very, very intellectual and interesting approach to training, so he's an interesting trainer to train with. John on the radio show mentioned Craig Douglas earlier, also known as South Narc. I've only taken a small class of his, but I've trained with a couple of his students, the guys that have worked with him extensively here in the Tulsa area, and his material as far as the combative and the close range stuff, in my opinion, is a must attend. You absolutely have to get that material. And then, you know, most of the other instructors I have would not be really well known on the national circuit per se, but they're just really good trainers that I've worked with in and around both the Federal Air Marshal Service and here in Tulsa when I used to work for USA, and just some exceptionally gifted people.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's the end of the show. Nick, I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
Hey, no problem. I'll talk to you online, I'm sure. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show tonight. I appreciate you taking the time out of your Sunday.
Thank you. You guys have a great evening.
Hey, you too. So, next week, we're going to be talking with Caleb Causey of Lone Star Medics. Oftentimes, the focus of surviving a critical incident centers on gun handling skills. What happens, though, if during a gunfight or even during a practice session you were injured? Next week, we'll be talking about his field medicine gunshot wound treatment and Caleb's unhealthy fascination with H2O. Should be a great show. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page, facebook.com/ballisticradio. And buy our t-shirt at booster.com/ballisticradio to help support Deputy Hopkins' recovery. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next Sunday at 7 p.m. right here on 55 KRC, the talk station.